1,000 watts, but actually it turned out it was only 50. And he claims he could hear three echoes between the Earth, the Moon, and back again on fixtures with 50 watts at Arecibo. What do you think of that one?
Oh, I've heard that one before, Barry. When you're using a 1,000-foot diameter dish on a frequency like 432, I don't know the exact numbers, but I can plug them into one of my equations I used to have, which I've got to reestablish. Let's see, did I do that? Did I put that one back in? I'm about to find out right now. That equation is back in. It's under signal processing. Faster right now. Sure enough, dish gain. My dish formula gives me 60% aperture efficiency. It runs frequency in gigahertz and diameter in feet. There we go. Frequency in gigahertz is 0.432. Diameter in feet is 1,000. 1,000-foot diameter dish in Arecibo has a calculated gain at 60% aperture efficiency of 60.57 dB of gain, 0.17 gigabeam beamwidth. There you go. In other words, when you're using the 1,000-foot Arecibo dish at 432 megacycles, put 1 watt into it, you've got more than 1 million watts of effective isotropic radiated power. It's got 60.7 dB of gain. The Moon is an object in space that to an Earthbound observer is 1/2 degree of beam width. But the 1,000-foot dish on 432 at Arecibo has a beam width of 0.17 degrees. Therefore, it can decide which valley on the Moon you want to reflect that signal off of. Be selective. You're not lighting up the whole Moon like almost every one of the antennas you and I put in our backyard. At 432, the free space loss to the Moon and back, on average, is 261 dB. 261 dB is the free space loss from Moon and back one way. Add 60 dB of gain on transmit, 60 dB of gain on receive. That puts him 120 decibels ahead. So therefore, if it was 261 free space, isotropic, 261, and he's got, 60.5, let's call it 121. 120, he's 121 dB ahead on one pad, 21, 1. He only has 140 dB of round trip on the first pad. If he's got a sensitive enough receiver, I'm fairly sure he can hear multiple bounces back and forth between Earth and Moon. So, that's an antenna. That's a really serious antenna. You and I can dream about owning an antenna like that, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I lost the tape recording that I had of his signal. That's KP4CMO. I remember him in my car right now, by the way. And I can recall watching his signal bounce around between S3 and S5. A lot of warble on it, a lot of shake around. His signal was not steady. But it was, while he was sending his CW signal, it was going from S3 to S5. This is off the Moon. This was on 2 meters. What a signal.
What were you using for a receiving antenna, Barry?
160-element collinear. Originally made by Cushcraft, but kind of modified. But it started out as 160-element collinear. It's pretty close to it.
With an ASL bearing on it. And, he was how many dB above your noise, Barry?
Didn't have anything to measure it with at the moment, but, you know, you could sort of figure that my noise level in my receiver was probably not, you know, showing up on the S meter. It might have been a half of an S unit, you know, background noise on the receiver. And his signal was anywhere between S3 to S5 bouncing around. So, very respectable signal. Clearly a good sideband signal.
Now, just think about what's taking place. The Moon is 250,000 miles away, 240,000 miles on average, a little bit more than 250,000 miles. And it is a chunk of dirt, 1,163 miles in diameter, with all kinds of pockmarks in it, where it's been hit with meteorites over the last 4.5 billion years. So this chunk of dirt, hanging in space, 250,000 miles away, a really lousy reflector. In other words, of all the power that hits the Moon, only 7% of it reflects back toward the Earth. Got 250,000 miles on the way out, 250,000 miles on the way back, round trip path on 432, 261 dB. So Arecibo with a 1,000-foot dish with 60.5 dB of gain is transmitting a few watts of power at the moon, selecting which valley is their favorite to reflect the signal off of, and it was a single sideband signal, and you sat there in Far Rockaway in Brooklyn with your collinear antenna aimed at the moon and listened to that signal. That's got to be fun type stuff. What's going on now, and Barry will verify on this one, is that in the last couple of years, a guy named Joe Taylor, K1JT, has really created a revolution. Instead of just transmitting ordinary Morse code or ordinary single sideband, Joe Taylor has come up with an ultimate technique of transmitting a four tone in just the right combination to represent the numbers and letters, numbers of the alphabet, here we go, letters of the alphabet and numbers. So he's created a technique of four tones and a very fancy digital signal processing program which looks for those four tones in the noise and makes a decision, yeah, tone number one and tone number three was there, okay, that's an A. Tone number two and tone number four was there with a particular timing characteristic, and that was the number two, and so on. So with this technique of using digital signal processing on carefully generated four tones, which AT65 technique, I think it's called, the Joe Taylor technique, you can now do moon bounce instead of a 160 element collinear, an antenna that was around 400 square feet of area that Barry used to use, one single Yagi on the chimney of his house, aimed at the horizon as the moon is coming up over the horizon, with 100 watts of solid state transmit power, can now do moon bounce. And that gives you about a 20 decibel advantage. That's that program and that technique of transmitting that coded message can dig 20 dB into the noise. And now very simple hardware can do moon bounce. And the guys who have spent 10 and 20 years of their life scratching out all of those QSOs on moon bounce to talk to all of those countries and all of those states are suddenly getting competition from their point of view by these Johnny-come-latelys, these fly-ins operators from their point of view, these people who come along that are now with very simple equipment doing moon bounce. And so a guy with very serious equipment, a kilowatt of power, a half dB of noise figure on the receiver, and 400 feet, square feet of antenna on a great big tower in a good location in a quiet part of the world, takes some number of years and maybe a decade to talk to people in, we'll say, 30 countries by way of moon bounce. And along comes a guy with modern-day Joe Taylor techniques, and that in a couple of months with simple equipment. So is it legal? Is it a fair comparison? Should we have a separate tally for the guys who do it with conventional equipment versus guys who are doing it with modern-day digital signal processing equipment, and so on? So there's a big argument going on right now as to how we should keep score, and is this really a legal QSO? Because in the old days, a legal contact consisted of two human beings at one sitting in front of the ham radio equipment, human hearing, heard a full set of call letters, one piece of unknown information, like signal strength or location, and Rogers in both directions that information was sent and received. That is a valid QSO. One sitting, full set of call letters, one piece of unknown information, Rogers that were received in both directions by a human set of ears at one sitting in front of the ham radio equipment. That is a valid QSO. Well, a machine is doing the QSO when you're doing radio teletype. That's a valid QSO. We have radio teletype contests, but we keep the score separate. But when you're doing moon bounce with a digital signal processing and the machine is doing the listening, is that a valid QSO? Gray zone here. Smoke hasn't settled on that one, and people are still arguing. Barry, if you're still in your car, I'd like to hear your opinion on all this. M2 moon bounce. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, you might be surprised at my answer. Maybe not, I don't know. I feel that the spirit of amateur radio is to make the unusable radio signal usable. We've done that with Meteor Scatter, we've done that with Moon Bounce, we've done that with Tropo, we've done it on the low bands, we've done it over and over and over again, and in the past, industry has picked up our lead, used the stuff, and sometimes the credit went to the radio amateurs that actually developed the ideas and got it working. I don't think that JT65 is any different. I think if the horse finishes the finish line, that is in the spirit of amateur radio. And guys like myself who sit there and say, oh, we did it with our ears and we did it with hundreds of thousands of watts of ERP. Well, we did. But just because this guy is smarter than us, you know, I think that's a cool move. And I just wish that he would develop the program just a little more so that you could have a casual conversation, so that you could say, how's the weather, what kind of signal are you getting, you know, and by the way, what's your name, this is our first contact, you know, I found you random, you know. If you could bring it to that point, I think it would be very cool. Right now, it's very much a hello and goodbye mode. He hasn't written into the software a way to have a casual conversation, whether it be transmitting voice back in the old days of Morse code, transmitting pictures when it comes to the invention of television. These are all new techniques, take a while to be accepted, but once they're accepted, it is wireless communication. Yes, it's being aided by a computer program, a fancy receiver, so on, a fancy demodulator. But I agree with you. It should count. It is progress. Useful information being sent in a wireless way over the ether, over free airspace. That is a good thing from my point of view. And so, although our original definition of a valid QSO did not completely anticipate this particular condition, that's irrelevant. Is real radio communication, once the smoke settles, Barry is saying it, and I think I'm saying it, like to be a real rag chew like we're having right now, where we pass information, we pick each other's brain, we pass information back and forth, and we teach each other the radio art, the wireless art. That's what's going on here. We're teaching each other the wireless art. That's what this QSO is all about. And so it's valuable from my point of view, because a man skilled in wireless techniques, the wireless art, can make a pretty darn good living. I have for the last 40 years. Barry has for the last 35 years. We're now living out of wireless technology. We do it as a hobby. We do it as an occupation. The two are almost the same, with some slight differences, a little bit of a twist. We enjoy it. We intend to keep doing it, as long as we're still breathing. How much longer are you going to work in wireless, Barry? N2FB, K2RIW, and the TechNet. Well, I'm hoping for another 50 years. I don't think I'll get it. But entering amateur radio in the cell phone age to really appreciate it. You know, when I started out as a kid, and you probably too, I think I was 12 years old when I first got my license. And I don't want to, you know, babble on about this, but I can remember working a fellow in England. I was so excited, I took a walk with my friend down to the ocean to look at the water to say that I actually spoke across that. Because you got to understand, in those years, a long-distance phone call was a big deal. Difficulty, the operator would fake the connection, call you back, was a whole big deal. I got to get my daughter out of this house, and I'll be right back, N2MB.
Thank you very much, Barry, for giving us a little bit of a picture of the romance from your point of view. It's a beautiful thing. I can see you standing at the oceanside in Far Rockaway, looking over the sea, saying 3,300 miles away, guy in England heard what I just did, communicated. And thank goodness the ionosphere supplied that support for you. The real free space loss, and we can plug in the numbers, between you and England, is going to be less than 140 dB. And that's if it was free space. It would be easy. Because of Earth curvature, adding another 200 dB to the loss, no way in hell, until the ionosphere comes along and the signal reflects. It's really a diffraction, but we won't get there. Say, it's an absorption and re-radiation, but it looks like reflection. When the ionosphere comes along, the signal reflects off the ionosphere, It takes two or three bounces between the ionosphere and the ocean, and pretty soon that guy in England almost sounds like he's in your backyard, and you hold that QSO with him. That's part of the magic of HF radio. UHF, SHF radio, EHF radio, 10 gigs, also does something similar. Kind of super refraction phenomena that takes periodically. And I talked to a guy at Rodan Beach, I think is the name of the place, in Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, 380 miles airline distance from me. He was running a 10-watt transmitter. I was running a 200-milliwatt transmitter. And we talked to each other first on Morse code and then on single sideband. I'm using a two-foot diameter dish at the 100-foot level of my tower with a solid-state transmitter at 10,000 meg, a transistorized transmitter that could have run on 12-volt batteries, could have run on flashlight batteries, so to speak, but it wasn't. And I'm running 0.2 watt. He was running 10 watts with a traveling wave tube with his 3-foot diameter dish on a tripod on the beach, Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And my free space Earth curvature limitation is roughly 43 miles. I can talk to somebody 43 miles away, line of sight. He was 380 miles away, and I'm running 0.2 watt, QRP. And I was 15 or 20 dB out of his noise with single sideband because Mother Nature was favoring that signal, as she does some portion of every single 24-hour day if you're within 200 miles of a major body of water, like the Atlantic Ocean. Okay, I think it's time to go to our next lesson. I think it's lesson number 5, Mel. And I've been getting lots of positive feedback of people who are saying, hey, it's about time, after all these years, I've been hearing about the Smith chart, it's about time somebody teach me the magic of what it does. That these crazy transmission lines, if I've got a 50-ohm transmission line, and I put a 50-ohm load at the far end, at the input end, I look at 50 ohms. Delight, no problem. Put any other pins on the far end of the transmission line, all kinds of crazy stuff happens. The impedance goes up and down, it becomes capacitive, it becomes inductive, the resistive component's going up and down, it goes around in circles on that Smith chart as you go down that cable, if there is anything but a 50-ohm load on the end of that cable. That Smith chart teaches you how to do that. A very complicated equation with four tangents in it, a bunch of trigonometric symbols, and complex mathematics, imaginary and real numbers, convicted for you mathematically. Magic of Mr. Smith, working for Bell Labs in 1938, is he came up with a chart that puts it all on one piece of paper. Not a super simple piece of paper to understand, but once you make the investment to learn how to understand it, it'll draw a lot of information that's very difficult to get to by other means. So Mel's about to give us a lesson number 5, I think it is. K2KEY, K2IW with TechNet. You got it, Professor.
Thank you. This is K2KEY, and oh boy, I got emails, Dick. Oh boy. I'll just briefly go over a number of them, entries, some of them. Well, anyway, one of them gives us a little bit of a compliment, and I'm going to pass it on to you. We're teaching technology course. Thank you very much. Then I had a number of emails asking me about individual antennas, make installations, and whether or not and I'm going to just basically comments here. Number one, as Dick has said, in an antenna like a dial, a number of them worst questions about simple antennas, because basically the vast majority of hams operate from an urban area or on a small plot of land or in a high riser, and they've got to have some kind of compromised antenna in many cases. They just can't put up what they like. And Dick has said that many times before, try to put if you cut a dipole, especially if you want to operate number, but want to operate HF, and then wondering what out of it. If you can get the dipole up, well, try to get it in the clear as best as possible. Try to cut it as close as you can to the frequency of desire. If it has to slope, if it has to bend, it has to droop, don't worry about it. Don't watch that SWR meter come transfixed on that needle, whether it moves a little or not. And of course, always with tape. I've been actually had radio in my Actually, I had radio also in my blood from the time I could remember. Pictures of me as a guy about 3 years old, diapers turning a knob on our old Zine Hansel radio we had in the house. So, way back and learned what I was basically 40 when I was 4 years old, my radio operator. That kind of background, anyhow, but I blame a lot of it on the magazine, Dick. Many of these magazines, what they do is they always share a guy on the cover that has a kilobuck station, kinds of linears piled up and everything you can fancy transceivers that cost, I don't know, almost prices, but half the price each one of a compact car. And then in the background you see his acreage of land and towers that go into the stratosphere with kinds of stacked arrays and all. So you show this to a prospective fan, and what do they say? I can't of that or do that or whatever. And they say, well, ham radio's not for me. So I blame it a lot on the magazine, Dick, over.
I don't blame you, Bill. The magazines have to sell that which is sensational. So a big fancy piece of equipment like you described, owned by a rich guy, he's one guy out of 1,000 or one guy out of 10,000. It makes it exciting. It makes it sensational. And therefore, on the front cover, it sells magazines. A simple dipole and a one-tube transmitter that you and I cut our teeth with, my first 6L6 transmitter, with a 7 megacycle crystal on the 40 meter, no, it was a 3.75 megacycle crystal, as I remember, 80 meter ham band, equivalent of a 6L6 tube and a 5U4 rectifier, and a Morse code key, and I think it transmitted like 25 watts or so. So that was my first transmitter, and had a lot of fun with that thing. That on the front cover of a magazine wouldn't sell. Nobody would buy it. It's trite. It's ordinary. Also, I think you're about to start telling me that you're getting a lot of email because you are virtually offering people free consulting service. You have to be careful with that. As I said on multiple times, because when I published my first couple of articles in QST Magazine, I would get hundreds and hundreds of letters per year. And in the beginning, you're diligent about it. You try to answer them all. And pretty soon, one particular guy in Snug Harbor, Maryland, mailed me 14 consecutive letters in a 1.5 month period. Each letter was 4, 5, 10 questions on 2 pieces of typing paper where he writes down the questions and leaves spaces in between where he wants answers. That's each letter, and 14 letters like that flowed in a 6-week period of time before I suddenly realized I can't live his life for him. The limit here. And so, because of my past experience along these lines, people who listen to the TechNet, sign in, ask your question. Verbally, I can give you an answer when I'm excited at 150 words a minute, and it's great. People who send me email, and I've got to type back my find and peck at 20 words a minute, and I got to figure out what question you're really answering, and it takes 2 or 3 communications back and forth, I am not volunteering to do that. So, you can send me email if you want to. I cannot guarantee you'll get an answer. I haven't offered that much of my man hours for the next X number of years. On the TechNet, I'll answer any question I possibly can. Occasionally, people call me on the telephone, and I can speak to them 150 words a minute. I'm willing to do that. But to type an answer to people, I'm not offering that. Maybe Mel is. I wonder how much longer he can continue doing that. He's got more stamina than I do. K2KEY,
K2IW,
the TechNet.
K2KEY, well, I'm not going to make a comment or answer any emails involving one particular manufacturer's antenna over another. Which would you suggest? And they give me a whole lot of their QTH. In fact, one guy included measurements, and he says, this is antennas that they offer this that company and all. Which one would you suggest I put in station? And I won't make a comment on that. I'm not sure, and yes, there's so many different possibilities, so I'm not going to comment. I'm going to tell everybody, I'm not going to comment on any one manufacturer's antennas, commercial antennas. As you see, they don't review in many magazines anymore, publish gain figures and things like that, because, you know, they're so subjective to the number of factors, exaggerations. Many manufacturers have sold antennas which were never really came to any reality. So with that, I just like to say I want to just mention that passing. They should have more emphasis on amateur radio stations, modest amateur radio stations, like Dick just said. I basically started the same thing with a dollar investment, all $5 surplus aircraft and a converter. I was applied for it, set a couple of tubes on a wood chassis, one crystal, and I have fun with it. This is I have fun with it. And
yes,
of course, I enhanced the mail bill. My XYL here is shaking her head. She says, you could have made phone calls the rest of your life around the world to watch investments. But that's beside the point. So with that, anybody want to make any comments about any of the above here before I get to this chart?
It's in the eye of the beholder as far as antennas are concerned.
This time.
Okay. Are we in the net mode? Did I hear that?
We sure are. Up until 11 o'clock, you're in the net mode. Enjoy.
Okay. I thought, did I hear is there a beep or a no beep, or was just a strictly regular net mode? Over?
We're in the net mode, and I'm promised by the technical committee that there is no timer, and there is no beep. Have at it.
Okay, got some changes then since last week. Very good. All right, now, last week, we'll get to the, with no further ado, as they say, we'll get to, back to ham radio. They cut a number of people who said that they never really understood it, and now are having a grand old time making measurements and getting to understand, and they just basically make copies of what we've had in the last four times around and just substitute their numbers in, and that to determine their different situations. Last week, Dick mentioned something that touched upon making measurements up here on VHF using lecture wires, and we just touched upon it, and tonight I thought, being we sort of working our way up the band, as they say. Started out at HF with HF antennas and matching coaxes and things like that, and networks and all and stuff. Now let's talk about maybe something up to date here with going up on to the VHF and UHF frequencies. And one of the things that's been around a long time, and yet a lot of hams know very little or nothing about what they call the UHF slotted line. And basically, a slotted line, very handy little simple gadget to put together, piece of equipment you can put together, is actually a piece of transmission line, and it's fitted basically with a movable probe, and to permit sampling of RF voltage along the line. You can put together such a thing, basically a description of a UH slotted line. You took a piece of light gauge aluminum, 36 inches long, and you bent it up in the shape of, say, like make up somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 3/4, and the bottom piece out 2 3/8, and then the other side up again, bend it up 3, it makes like a U. And on the end of this trough that you just made, you put two plates to close off the inner center of these aluminum plates on each end, and stick a pin seat type connector, normal 90s, and you suspend then a rod, aluminum rod with like an old half inch, and you suspend it between these BNC connector centers, and now you just have to make another little carriage, a little cover, basically the same size to fit over the top of this open bus, a little bent down side so that it will ride along it like a track. And what you do then is put another UHF BNC connector in the middle of this little plate. On the bottom, you solder a little bit of a piece of a strip of copper. That's called a probe. Now, you can hook to this UHF connector an indicator, and it can be as simple as a microamp meter and a diode. Take a piece of it, will come off of it, put a couple of turns coil on the end of the cable and connect it to couple it to your rigid meter, put it in absorption. And that's basically the picture. Fine. X can do it, one of them. But any questions about how a UHF slotted line is put together first, over?
Mel, I'm going to tell you that your push-to-talk switch is giving you a little bit of trouble. You had a couple of dropouts there, but only for a fraction of a second each time. And that trough that on the slotted line that Mel just described, because the trough has got fairly high sides to it and a reasonable width at the bottom, And he said an aluminum rod, I would make it a brass rod going down the center, which is easier to solder to. Oh, I see, we have a little bit of extra noise coming through here tonight. The main thing that the slotted line, the magic of it, is that it does not reheat. Because it is a three-sided shielded structure, it does not radiate, and therefore only the probe sticking down near that center conductor picks up any signal. Let's see if your signal is loud enough to overcome this melt. If you just remove the outer shield of the coax cable, you really wouldn't have an efficient transmission line. But there's ways that you can partially open the outer shield of the transmission line such that radio-wise it's still a thoroughly shielded structure, yet your eye sees it as something that's open. So if you cut the slot fine enough, or if you make it with parallel plates so that the slot is far enough away from the center conductor, the thing doesn't radiate. The main thing you're doing with a slotted line is maintaining 50 ohms and not making it into an antenna. Then when you stick a probe down into that slot, it does a minor sampling of the signal that's going on that center conductor. That probe you put down there maybe only has one picofarad of capacitance between the probe and the center conductor, and it picks up a signal that's 1% or 0.1% of what's there, but if the signal is strong enough, that's enough. Then by that slider, that the carriage that Mel was just mentioning, by moving the carriage, which is moving the probe further down or further up the slotted line, you're sampling a signal at the beginning, the middle, the end, or whatever. And the way transmission lines work, whenever there is a improper impedance match, you develop something called standing wave ratio. Fancy way of saying you got a signal flowing forward, you got a signal flowing back. In certain spots in the line, those two signals are in phase with each other, and you get a peak in voltage there. At some other spot on the line, the two signals, the forward-flowing signal and the reverse-flowing signal, are out of phase with each other, and you get a null. Ratio between the peak voltage at one spot and the null voltage at the other spot tells you how strong is the reflected signal. But that ratio, that's the ratio we're talking about, standing wave ratio. Standing wave meaning it sits still, so to speak. The peak stays in one spot, the valley stays in one spot. You move that carriage back and forth, you find the peak voltage, you find the valley voltage, and that tells you how good a job you're doing at putting a proper impedance on the end of that transmission line. So that's what Mel's having you construct here. With that trough line, it is a non-radiating structure. Radio-wise, it is thoroughly shielded. But as far as your eye is concerned, it looks like it's open on one of the four sides of the trough, and that's where Mel put his carriage and his probe, and he's able to figure out what's going on that line without putting a zillion connectors that he opens up. That probe sliding up and down the line is the equivalent of a whole bunch of T-connectors, so to speak, where he can figure out what's happening at each spot along the line. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yes. That's basically very good description of the modded line. And for this used piece of equipment and the Smith chart, what we'll do, we can discuss a little bit more further with the slotted line. You can make a number of measurements like Dick said. You can determine wavelength, determine SWR and things like that. For this particular use we're going to do tonight with the Smith chart. Let's say we have an antenna that's for 450 megahertz, what we commonly call 70 centimeter band, and we'd like to know what the open piece of the antenna is. So, a way we can do this is connect the slotted line, one end of it, to the 450 megahertz antenna. Then connect to the other side of the slotted line. For this demonstration, we'll use a bird wattmeter UHF plug in there with 1,000 megahertz plug-in slug. Bird wattmeter, true line wattmeter. And we'll hook our generator to the input of the bird wattmeter. And we'll set it up in that fashion. Okay, the next thing we're going to do now For making measurements now, let's determine, first of all, what is the exact electrical length of 150 megahertz. And to do that, we just take 300 times 10 to the 6th power, divide it by 450 times 10 to the 6th power. Electrical length of 450 megahertz is 67 centimeters. The electrical length. Now the next thing we're going to do, going to now measure the SWR. Let's say for demonstration, we measure an SWR of 2.5 VSWR on the Berg watt meter. Now with our compass, take our compass and the pin of the compass on 1.0, go to the right of that point, and you'll see, as you go down the line, you'll see a point that says 2, and then you on, you'll see it says 3. So right in between those two points on the center axis, put a dot. Right? With that dot, open up the compass to that dot, and swing a 360 circle. Now we know somewhere along that circle is the peak we're looking at. Now what we're going to do next, in order to get it, we have to have two measurements, max and a minimum. Dick had mentioned, we slide the carriage along our slotted line, and we see that our indicator, which again, the indicator could be a very simple device, could be a diode and a microamp meter or whatever, and we see, we try to find a minimum. Find the minimum, we take a measurement, our metric ruler, and for demonstration, we'll say at this point, that is 6.7 centimeters. Now, 6.7 centimeters, we'll have to say to ourselves, well, what part, what electrical length will that be in reference to 450 megahertz? So again, all we do now, very simply, divide 6.7 centimeters by 67 centimeters that we determined before with the electrical length of about 450 megahertz, and it equals to 0.1 wavelength, right? You take this now. Remember now, we're going to look at the Smith chart now with something we haven't done before. Previously, we looked at the Smith chart and we did use one of the outer rings. Mostly, measurements we made were towards wavelengths towards the generator. You'll notice the outer ring says wavelength towards the generator. But this time, because we're looking to find the load antenna, we're going to be looking at wavelengths towards the load. Now, with that 0.1 wavelength in mind, down the ring, now load a line, below the center line, if you follow along, you'll see in that outer ring, that second step where it says wavelength towards load, see a point that says 0.1. At that point where it says 0.1, put your straight edge, and extend the straight edge to the center of the chart to the 1.0, and we draw a straight line right between. And you'll notice this line now has bisected our original circle, the 2.5 SWR that we drew. What we're going to do now is just read that spot. The spot will read something 0.56, and because it's below the axis, center axis, it's minus J0.56. Now, if we want to get it actually in resistance and in positive reactance, metric values, supply it by 50, divide 0.56, we get 28 ohms resistance minus J, 28 ohms capacitive. Very simple. We use a very simple device, and we, in many cases, hams can make laboratory measurements with spotted line. All right, let me, if anybody has any questions or tips, I said, KRIW to K2KEY.
Very fine. The one thing you didn't make clear yet is that you moved the carriage to a point that indicated 6.7 centimeters. However, it's 6.7 centimeters from a reference point. Reference point was either a short circuit or an open circuit at the point where you're going to connect the unknown antenna, the 2.5 standing wave ratio antenna. So, reading by itself is a little bit hard to interpret until you know something of standard. And the three standards that are often used on slotted lines are short circuit, an open circuit, or a 50 ohm load, or maybe even a 100 ohm load if you want to see what 2-to-1 standing wave ratio looks like. So, with that, I agree. That's something I've heard. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, right. I forgot to add that in. That you can, to calibrate, what they use is a number of ways you can make this three gummy loads that were commonly used to make the setup a plotted line. And what they used to use, take a BNC male connector, and let's see, I think, let's see, number 47 pile light, and then the resistor, a short, and measure half wave and a long cable. And that was for basically the calibration, initial calibration of the slotted line.
How about a position open and a position short?
Yeah, that's really what he was saying when he talked about a reference spot. The slotted line itself, when you build it by most techniques, has nothing inside but air and conductors. Your outer conductor is a trough. Your center conductor is a rod made out of steel, aluminum, copper, brass, whatever. But the dielectric in between the two is air. And the right diameter of rod compared to the dimensions of your trough, when you got the right ratio of those dimensions, it is at the ohm transmission line. We didn't mention that up till now. So all reasonable slotted lines used in the United States, the slotted line itself is an air-filled 50-ohm transmission line. Because it's air-filled, the velocity factor is essentially unity. In other words, the signal goes down there at the same speed as it would in free space, whereas your coax cable made out of polyethylene or Teflon or foam polyethylene has a much slower velocity factor. Ordinary RG8U cable, for instance, made polyethylene, has a 66% velocity factor. Fancy way of saying the signal goes down there 66% of the speed of light. With our air trough slotted line, it goes down there at the speed of light. We're at a wavelength of 66.666 centimeters, Martinell's example, and because a standing wave beats every half wavelength. A little bit funny to explain why it does that. Maybe Mel will get into that later. But you're going to get half wavelength between the troughs. To measure the peak on a slotted line, the peak response when you slide your carriage up and down, the peak is very broad, whereas the trough, the null, is very, very sharp. So when people want to measure wavelength, in the old days, before you had frequency counter, a slotted line is a beautiful way of finding out what frequency you're transmitting on. You move the slotted line, the trough, until maybe with the light bulb, until you got minimum brilliance in one spot, and you would mark it. You would move it down the line further until you get another null, another minimum brilliance. You'd measure between the two. This example, had he done that, he would have seen 33.33 centimeters difference, in other words, a third of a meter difference between the troughs. So the thing is repeating in half wavelength, you double the 33.33 of the measurement, you'd get 66.66, you would know your wavelength is 66.66, and if you wanted to do the conversion, you'd figure out that that meant 450 megacycles. Amazed for how many decades people measured frequency with a slotted line, or the equivalent. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Exactly, this is K2KUY. Yes, slotted line has been used extremely for a number of measurements over years when we've had the instrumentation that we had, the amazing accuracy. In fact, if properly calibrated, And I've seen that with whole lot of lines you can measure SWR, as Dick was just mentioning, down to 7-to-1. It's amazing what can be done with a very simple instrument like this. I use the demonstrate this at the third watt meter to measure the SWR. The reason for that is to basically see if it's on the slotted line an indicator, like I mentioned, something like a microwave meter and a diode. You got a little bit of a problem there because not measuring, actually reading now rectified current. So you got to be careful. whereas SWR ratio it has to be I max to I minimum of RF current. With the setup, a basic setup like just using microamp meter, diode as the detecting device on the probe, or grid meter, and absorb can't really determine actual SWR, actually the RF current. But there's another way of doing that. You can calibrate actually RF power, if of course if you have something like a bird might watt meter, and use that for the calibration purposes of the different times.
That's exactly it. You could run your transmitter up and down, and you could read the power on the bird watt meter. You'd look at the rectified voltage on your probe that's on the carriage of the slotted line. So at 1 watt of power, maybe you get 15 microamps of current flowing, and at half a watt of power, you get 30 microamps of current flowing. So by running the power up and down and looking at the current or voltage, whatever is the indicator, on your probe of the slotted line, you can calibrate the probe. Or you can do it with a step attenuator. Leave the transmitter alone and operate the step attenuator in 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 20 dB steps and so on. Hewlett-Packard made a beautiful meter. I think it was called the 405 Manning Wave Ratio Meter. And later on, Mel made mention how you use that. And the nice thing about the standing wave ratio meter, which you connected to the probe in the carriage, is that it had tremendous amounts of dynamic range. It used the probe and the crystal detector at low levels were known to have a square law characteristic. Mathematically, it's very predictable, and you almost didn't have to calibrate. But almost everything, no matter what kind of an instrument you build, eventually you usually have to calibrate it. You have to refer it to something else, which hopefully eventually is referable back to the Bureau of Standards. We call that traceable to the Bureau. So we amateurs sometimes forget about that. A manufacturer may tell you that that beautiful Yagi you bought has got 18 dB of gain. May have fibbed. It may have fibbed by 10 dB. You got to be careful. And therefore, calibrating is sometimes very important to find out the real truth of what's going on. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY. K2RIW on the TechNet.
No, exactly, Dick. The picture that was made, Packard made a very fine instrument in RF air step. In fact, worked on vacuum tubes in those days. In fact, was another one that I have to have that was very similar, made by a company called Blue. And basically, you could read with accuracy 100 to 1. Basically, what that would basically translate, if you had 10 watts forward, you could make 1 lected. That would be basically weight that would be SWR, something like 1.22 to 1, I assume, Dick, right? Correct? Over.
I think that's true. I was doing the calculation of the 1.07. By the way, 1.07 standing wave ratio, which Mel is predicting that a careful guy using a slotted line can get that kind of accuracy. That is a reflection coefficient of 29.4 decibels. In other words, 99.9% of your power is flowing in the right direction. And if there was an error in the resistance component of your antenna, a 1.07 standing wave ratio means that your antenna is a 53.5 ohms instead of 50 ohms. An extremely minor difference to academic stuff here. So I was doing that and not paying complete attention. Sorry about that, Professor.
Bring me a note from home. All right, anyhow, as I was saying, you know, reading SWR, you know, again, here I'm going to start because I'm going to try to eliminate a whole load of emails about people, again, with the SWR and tell me about the meter wiggling and if I continue using the antenna or not. How important is SWR? Especially we thought about 1.21 and things like that. Not really very important. Again, I'm going to overemphasize that. Not very important. If you're just interested in getting an antenna to work as well as its practical possibility, make it. But being able to see how low values is not important. Believe me, we're just doing this as a laboratory experiment as a demonstration of another application of the Smith chart and all. But when Dick and I start discussing SWR and we talk about 1.07 as possibilities and things like that, of getting below 1.2 to 1, believe me, it's not going to make any kind of difference what, no matter what somebody is listening to. Not going to say, oh boy, what did you do? Your signal jumped up so much, and you said, well, I went down to less than 1.2 SWR by making an adjustment. It doesn't happen that way, so don't aggravate yourself. Don't torture your life in trying to get it better. This is just for technically discussing a situation with a piece of equipment. Back to you, Dip.
I agree. Most people would be horrified with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, as bad as it sounds, in the worst case, is half a dB of real transmission loss. That's if the transmitter itself was a pure 50 ohm load and absorbing all the reflected power. And transmitters don't even do that. Even that's a pessimistic assessment. Half a dB of loss on a transmitter is supposed to be, on a well-calibrated S meter, 6 dB per S unit. In other words, if your signal went from S8 to S9 on a well-calibrated S meter, that's supposed to be a 6 decibel difference, a 2-to-1 voltage ratio. S9, by the way, is supposed to be 50 microvolts in your receiver. Therefore, S8 is 25 microvolts. You made a full S unit change. That's 6 decibels, 4-to-1 difference in power. Half dB is the amount of loss you get from a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That's 1/12 of 1 S unit. Guy is never going to know the difference. The normal QSB, in other words, the variation of the ionosphere, is going to give you half an S unit on a good day, up and down, during his time of transmitting. So half a dB, he would never see it. So to most guys, 2-to-1, and to most commercial companies, 2-to-1 is the criteria of acceptable standing wave ratio. In critical measurements, maybe it's more like 1.5, but 2-to-1 in most circles is acceptable. There's a slight catch. Modern-day solid-state transmitters that don't have a tuning and loading control anymore, the transmitter starts cutting itself back, it starts protecting its final at a little bit below 2-to-1. Some of them 1.6, 1.7 is when the transmitter starts cutting back in power output to protect the final stage. So this gives you a little bit of an idea of where the acceptability is. In some circumstances, when you're using a tuner, a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio with a low loss feed line could be a very acceptable antenna, where your antenna tuner is taking the 10-to-1